A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio with me, Georgie Frost. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning money section of The Mail Online, join me in the studio for our weekly catch-up. Editor Simon Lambert is joined by journalist Lee Boyce to talk through the top stories that they've been investigating, including, well, the tax year ends at midnight on April the 5th. So savers, investors, have until then to stash away this year's ISA allowance. But if you haven't acted yet, what can you do? Where are the best cash ISAs? Also, a day after that, the new pension freedoms come in, but watch out for the fraudsters. We also reveal the true 10 most economical cars to run. Why do I say true? We'll let you know about that too. And want to live a happy life in the country? Move to Rutland, apparently. Plus, we're asking today, it's International Children's Book Day. We spoke earlier to an international children's author, so we're asking, books from your childhood, please. Your favourite books from your childhood. Editor Simon Lambert and journalist Lee Boyce, please. Simon, book from your childhood, your favourite?
I was a proper little bookworm when I was a kid. I used to love reading. In fact, so much that I used to like secretly read with a bedside lamp by the side of my bed that I'd sort of twist over so it was like slightly hidden on the pillow, and actually managed to set fire to my pillow one night and had to go downstairs to tell my parents set fire to my bed.
Reading though, that's
yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
I can think of worse reasons why
they
basically set fire
told
to your
me
pillow.
They told me in future to just read with the light on normally, and it wasn't a problem. I used to love Roald Dahl books. I think my favourite is Matilda, actually. I love Matilda. In fact, my eldest daughter's middle name is Matilda after that. And I used to love Just William as well. I thought they were great.
Lee, yourself?
A bit like Simon, actually. I was a bit of a bookworm as well. Two standout books from my childhood, The Hobbit and Treasure Island. Probably not your typical children's books, but they are the two that I remember reading, you know, as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old. Absolutely fantastic.
Katie, what have people been saying? Roald Dahl is so up there.
He is, and I have to say, Simon, Matilda, my favourite too, so good choice. And you're not the only one. Katie says Matilda, Rich also says Matilda, BFG, the Twits, the Witches, these are all coming up. Other authors that are popular, other books, Gareth says Fungus the Bogeyman, Ben says Varjak Paw, which I've looked it up, it is a book. I thought he might have just leant on his keyboard by accident. James says Watership Down. And Michael, who lives in London but was born in Melbourne, says Boffer the Great Motorcycle Race.
There's some classics in amongst that.
I tell you what, actually, because I do have two young children, I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and some of the children's books at the moment are also equally as good. They're really good. I mean, they're obviously much younger than most of the books that are getting reeled out there, which are proper stories. But truly, the Julia Donaldson, the woman who writes the Gruffalo, those Gruffalo books are absolutely brilliant for kids, and kids love them. But they're great because the reason is because for younger kids, you've got the wonderful illustrations and the pictures, but there's not too many words on the pages. You find sometimes with kids' books for younger kids, there's way too many words, and the kids totally lose attention before you've even managed to read four lines. So actually, there's like an optimum amount of text you can have on those pages.
Hands up in the studio who knows what Simon's talking about because they've got kids themselves. That'll be no one. Yeah, OK, on your own there, Simon.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce here with me today, looking at the stories that they've been investigating this week. But before we do that, let's start by looking at a few topical stories making the headlines today. And one of Britain's big six energy firms, E.ON, has been fined nearly £8 million for overcharging its customers. The industry regulator Ofgem says it's linked to exit fees that should never have been billed. Well, £400,000 has already been refunded to those affected. Citizens Advice will get some of the money that E.ON has been fined. Simon, your response to this, please.
Well, what I like about this story is the fact that obviously E.ON's been fined, but the fact that the fine is going to Citizens Advice and £7.75 million it's a sizable chunk of money. It's the kind of sum of money that should hopefully make a difference. And I'd actually like to see more of this with these companies who get fined for doing something wrong to their consumers, be it energy companies or banks or financial firms, is instead of that money going into a pot that the regulator controls or the watchdog controls in some way, get it out there doing some good, because that money will make a real difference at Citizens Advice. And Citizens Advice do an absolutely fantastic job basically helping people out, like real people out there on the street coming to them with genuine problems.
Do you think consumers are starting to get one back over the energy companies?
Probably, I think so. It's got a lot tougher on energy firms in the last few years, hasn't it? I mean, we've seen a big push for them just to, you know, simply lower their prices, which, you know, this time round you could argue they haven't done by enough, but they have done. And I think that if you compare the situation now to, say, the situation 2 years ago, I think consumers are getting a better deal.
Lee, I should have been clear earlier. What are exit fees? What is the big problem here that E.ON have done wrong?
So it should be quite easy and quite transparent for people to move energy supplier. And there's a lot of comparison websites and tools now that, you know, consumers can use to find out if they can get a cheaper energy bill. So I'm guessing what's happened in this situation is people have said, look, I'm going to move to another company because they're going to offer me a cheaper yearly deal. And E.ON hasn't played ball and is threatening people, well, is charging people for leaving their contract.
Are E.ON the only ones to do this? Are we expecting more to come that, or we just don't know yet?
I don't think we know yet, to be perfectly honest. But what, you know, as I said, what's interesting is where this money from this fine has gone. And also, as you said, Georgie, people, it does seem that they're getting a bit tighter on these energy companies. So maybe we will see quite a bit more of this.
Well, because the cost of energy is one of the big problems, I think, that we have in terms of personal financing and budgeting. However, if you listen to what's been in the news this week, apparently we're all feeling that little bit better off. And I say that little bit better off, apparently 0.2% better off from 2010. That's apparently our financial well-being of UK households. Also today, Asda's income tracker says that families have around £16 a week more in their pockets than they did a year ago. That's a 9.2% rise. And the cost of weekly grocery shopping is continuing to fall by 1% in the last month, 7% over the last year. Lots of stats there, apologies. But are we all feeling really flush?
I think this Asda income tracker has been heavily skewed by the fuel drops that were witnessed in February. So petrol prices come plummeting down, and it means people were spending less to fill up their car. However, since this, petrol prices have gone up, you know, 10 pence a litre again in the last month. So I think this time next month we'll be looking at some stats that suggest that this figure's gone down again, and people don't have as much disposable income again to spend on non-essential items.
So Chancellor George Osborne shouldn't be rubbing his hands with glee
no, just
yet. Simon?
I tell you what, it actually is interesting about this is that it sounds that £16 a week really doesn't sound like a lot, does it? But actually, that 9.2%, that's a really big jump in the amount that people have when you consider that wages are only going up by about 2%. And the other thing is that the fall in food prices of 7% is really substantial. And that's feeding through from all this competition from the supermarkets going head-to-head with the discounters, all trying to undercut each other. And we have seen a change in the trend, basically. And the trend for quite a prolonged period of time was for our household essentials to be going up and up and up and up and just grinding away and hitting people in the pocket. And now they are on the downward trend. Quite how long that can continue, I don't know. I mean, Lee made the point about petrol prices. Mm-hmm. You know, that's heavily influenced the inflation figure. Now, if we see petrol prices continue to go up a bit and then sit at that higher level, in a year's time, inflation figures are going to look quite different, because you might find that also you've got some energy firms putting up some prices as well. The end of this sort of food deflation that we're seeing. And you might find that we're closer to that 2% inflation target than we are to the 0% we've got at the moment.
Also, interestingly, comparethemarket.com did a consumer manifesto. They interviewed 6,000 UK adults and found that 40% of consumers feel worse off. And they also outline the top three personal finance priorities that they want from the next government. Majority was the increase the personal tax allowance. Second came freeze energy prices. And third came more state aid in meeting elderly care costs. Energy second there. What about your readers? What are their priorities, do you think?
Well, for many of them, it's higher interest rates now, because they're earning such a poor amount on their savings.
Didn't you say it was split, though, last week?
Yeah, it was. Like, it was the poll that we did was the two biggest chunks were literally the now and the not for a very, very long time. You know, that illustrates the gulf that there is in thinking on this. But I do genuinely think that if you had asked people the question over the past 5 years, what are your two biggest financial concerns, beyond people saying they didn't have enough money, it would be basically my wages aren't going up and the price of everything I buy is going up quite sharply. And that's changing a bit. But you've got other issues like, you know, house prices are very high. People are looking at, you know, interest rates being low. And we're not out of the woods yet. But I do think that there is an element that if you are, go out there and you were to poll the people on the street, they are saying that things are getting a bit better. And that's not just a London thing now. I think it is across the rest of the country. Stuff's still tight, but I do think a lot of people think it's looking better than it was 2 years ago.
Coming up, everything you need to know to beat the last-minute ISA deadline.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Very warm welcome. If you've just joined us, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, live in the studio with me now. Coming up, we'll be discussing new pension freedoms. They're just around the corner, but watch out for the scammers. We discuss who they are and what you can do to help. But first, not help them, help yourself. But first, the tax year ends at midnight on the 5th of April, and savers and investors have until then to stash away this year's ISA allowance. So if you haven't acted yet, what can you do? And is it still worth making that last-minute dash to the bank? Well, Lee, you've been looking into this. Let's start with the basics.
Sure.
What's an ISA?
So £15,000 limit. You can put maximum into a cash ISA, put a maximum into a stocks and shares ISA, or you can mix and match between the two. It's tax-free, so the money is protected against the tax from the tax man. They've been going on for a number of years, so people have built up heavy allowances. Some will have nest eggs that are worth a substantial amount of money. So getting the best rate on the balance that they've got is important, and people do still like an ISA.
So the deadline approaches. Why are we talking about this? Surely if you wanted to put some money away, you would have done it, well, ages ago. You've had a whole year to do it.
Well, it's interesting that there's lots of data that shows that people actually wait until February or March to use their ISA allowance, because traditionally in the past, there was something that all the experts dub cash ISA season, in which banks and building societies would come up with better rates to try and attract more savers. But unfortunately, in the last couple of years, it's just dwindled, and fewer providers are doing it and actually offering rates that are attractive. One firm says that today is actually the busiest day for people to top up their ISAs as well. So people could still be putting money into their ISAs. It's not all about the people that are still looking to open one.
So where can you go? What can you do? You've been looking into this.
Indeed. So a couple of providers have already shut their doors, which I think are quite interesting. Tesco Bank, for example, is not opening any new cash ISAs.
Why do you find that interesting?
Well, I just think that there's still enough time from the start of this week to process an application for an ISA. I don't really understand why you'd stop. And the same with post office.
I was going to
say,
I think it's a reflection of the fact that banks just aren't really that interested in having people's money at the moment, which is illustrated in the lack of competition in savings rates. In years gone by, as Lee says, we would have been, you know, running this roundup of who's shutting their doors at the last minute, yeah, kind of thing. They'd all be saying, yeah, we're open later than them, we're open later than them. Yeah. That's just not happening now, is it?
A couple of years ago, I would have been a broken man right about this time. I'd have been writing about five ISA stories a day. I'd be collapsing at my desk, but as
why the
it is, it's been a bit of a non-event. A large reason for it is a funding for lending scheme. You know, banks and building societies are not really that keen to take savers' cash as they have been in the past.
Remind us about the funding for lending
scheme. So it's £80 billion worth of money that banks and building societies can tap into from the government to lend out in the form of mortgages. That's why mortgage rates have fallen and there's been more mortgage lending, and also for lending for small businesses. And they've stopped using the cash now to lend out in the form of mortgages. However, a lot of banks and building societies have built up quite big buffers of this funding for lending cash. So the need to take in money in the form of cash ISAs and attract savers is just diminished, I'm afraid. But in the terms of can you still open one and where you can go, we've got a full list on our website. So I've contacted all the providers, major providers. Most are still open, and a lot of them are open until midnight on Sunday, which is the last day of the tax year. So to play it safe, if you're really going to leave it that last minute, I would, you know, be calling them in the afternoon. Still open them in branch on the Saturday. So obviously branches are going to be shut tomorrow because of it being Easter. So there's actually less time than there would be in most other years to make the most of this. But many are open on Saturday, and some sort of like Metro Bank, it's open till 6 p.m. on Saturday, so you can still open up an application till then.
Now, I was going to ask you whether it's worth it, but then I, in front of me, have Simon Lambert's article here. Interest rates are rubbish and savers are getting the short straw, but it's still worth getting an ISA. Take the floor, Simon.
Well, that's true. So, firstly, what I would say about this last minute thing is that, yes, obviously, it would make much more sense if you had some money to put it in an ISA for the year last April, because then you'd be earning all that nice tax-free interest for a year. But it's not just us journalists who basically consider a deadline something to aim about half an hour after.
Touché.
You know, when it comes to things in life, basically people do stuff at the last minute. That is the cold, hard reality. You can tell them to do things early as much as you like, but, you know, you do them at the last minute. So if you haven't put your money in an ISA this year, do still try and do it. And the reason why this is worthwhile is because once it's in there, it's sheltered from tax. If you put it into a cash ISA, you get your interest paid tax-free. If you put it into an investing ISA, a stocks and shares ISA, where you can invest in shares, funds, investment trusts, your dividends are tax-free, and also you won't pay any tax on the capital gains. There's another really, really handy thing about this, which is if you are a higher rate taxpayer, you should theoretically be declaring your savings interest and your dividends and capital gains on a tax form, on a self-assessment form. If you've got it in an ISA, you don't need to do that, so it saves you a bit of a headache. But the reason why I say that this is worth it is because you might think, oh, well, I don't have enough money to worry about it now. But it's aspirational. You might have more money in one day. In fact, you might consider that your ISA actually becomes perhaps part of your pension fund. So, for example, you're not going to put it into a pension, but you put some money in there. It's a much more flexible place to keep that money. And then in years to come, you can draw an income from it tax-free. Now, in the budget, George Osborne announced that from next April, everybody's going to have this £1,000 free, tax-free savings allowance. So the first £1,000 of interest, albeit if you're a higher rate taxpayer, that's only £500. And you can have we mentioned this last week, you can have a lot of money in a savings account before you hit that. I think the figures we ran, it was about £74,000 on current savings rates. But savings rates are at a really low level at the moment. When they go up, that amount you can have in that pot will fall. So if savings rates, if the average easy access savings rate went to just 3%, which is not a lot of money in historic terms, that number would drop down into the 30,000s. Secondly, that could be changed. So say Labour government gets elected, decide they don't like it, have an emergency budget in June, that £1,000 tax-free savings allowance could be gone before it's even started. But I find it much less likely that any future government would mess with the tax-free interest from an ISA, because that's the entire principle of the ISA scheme. And there would be uproar from people if that was suddenly taken away. Politicians know that, and they would be very careful about meddling with it. So get an ISA, rates are rubbish, banks and building societies are doing the dirty on you, paying you terrible savings rates, making all kinds of excuses whilst making extra money, but put your money in an ISA.
OK, Lee, then tell us which ISAs are the best, why you're happy to pick each account.
So we have a set of savings tables on the This Is Money website, and these are independently picked. So we just put in what are the best deals, and they go in there. So we've got just easy access ISAs, ISAs that come with a bonus, ISAs that come without a bonus, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year fixed deals. What we've done in this little guide here is to pick what we think are the five best ISAs. So sometimes there might be something a little bit innovative or different that we can put in here that might not necessarily be in that table, or we can't explain it properly in that table because it's just a table. So unfortunately, the days of innovative ISAs, when I first started this guide, have kind of diminished. So we had, for example, a couple of years ago, Santander had an ISA that was linked to Rory McIlroy. So if he won a major, you'd get a 0.1% bonus on your ISA.
And they got that, didn't they?
They got that.
They won a major and they got their
0.1%. And you know, I thought that was, it's a little bit, you know, gimmicky, but at the same time, it still had a bit of excitement and a bit of interest. And it's that sort of stuff that quite heavily usually featured in these five favourite Best Buys. Now, it's just real bog standard accounts, I'm afraid, that's currently making up what's in here. So of our five favourite ISAs, we've got the Post Office Online ISA. You can't open a Post Office ISA now in branch. You can only open one up online. It pays 1.5%. That is the best pay. That is the best buy easy access cash ISA. There's a couple that offer that. National Savings and Investments also have a 1.5% ISA. That one doesn't accept transfers in from other providers. We've got a two-year fixed from Clydesdale in Yorkshire at 2.1% and a one-year fix from Virgin at 1.65%. So that one-year fix offers you slightly higher interest than if you just put it in an easy access account. And theoretically, in a year's time, you'd move the money to something else. So also got a three-year fix at 2.15%. But you can hear it in my voice. These are not exciting rates. They're not anything to write home about, I'm afraid. And
sadly, you have to. It's part of your job.
I have to. And readers do get a little bit irate and they want to know, you know, these aren't great rates. But I don't set the rates. We can only write about what the top rates are in the market at the moment. And unfortunately, these are the top rates. And the only thing that might happen next week with the new tax year, there might be a few new accounts that come out. There might be a mini battle for Best Buy, but my hunch is there won't be.
It's worth bearing in mind, actually, on this, is that inflation has fallen to 0%. So you are actually getting a return on your savings, what's called a real return on your savings, a return above inflation. The other thing is that if you've got lots of money in a cash ISA, much more than you need in a rainy day fund, and you will not need that money in the short term, i.e. you're not planning on using it to buy a house in the next 5 years or something, then you should probably consider investing some of it. And with that long-term horizon, you know, the stock market should rise over time, reinvest your dividends, choose good investments, watch out for costs. You should do much better than cash. And people who put money into an investing ISA this time last year will have done much better than they would have done in cash. And actually, if you look at almost every single year going back, you know, over history, there'll be a handful where the stock market crashed, where they didn't do so well. But in most of those years, they would have comfortably beaten cash.
Now, I have something to put to you. It's from a listener. Can I ask a question about the new first-time buyer ISA due to launch in autumn? I understand you can have one ISA, either this one with limited funds or a regular ISA. Now, here's the thing. My son has a child ISA. He'll be 16 this July. I understand for the next 2 years, he could have both a child ISA and an adult ISA, full allowance. If this is the case, can he continue with his child ISA and I open a second first-time buyer ISA for him?
So they like to make these things complicated, don't they? Hey? I do not know the answer to that question. What I do know is that the system is definitely way too complicated. And it would be much easier if everybody just had an ISA allowance. This child ISA, the junior ISA thing, is absolutely insane. They introduced a whole new system for kids. They should have just given kids an ISA allowance, a standard ISA allowance, and let them put money into it. And if they were worried about parents sheltering extra money from tax, which, let's face it, how many parents can actually fill a £15,000 ISA in 1 year, let alone then start filling up their kids' ones? They should have just given children a lower ISA allowance rather than having a completely separate system. Again, with this Help to Buy ISA, it's like, well, you can have one or you can have the other. I think that everyone should just have a ISA wrapper. Basically, they should have a personal allowance, £15,000 a year. They can use any account they want to put that money into, and there should just be a big ISA wrapper that incorporates everything, which, if they're not going to put all the systems into just one system, you can just put everything into that pot. Because we're going to see another ISA probably come out soon, I think, which is the talking about doing a peer-to-peer lending ISA.
That's right.
So that's going to muddy the waters even further.
Well, we will stop talking about ISAs for a while and turn our attention to the top 10 most economical new cars revealed by experts who test them in real-world conditions.
Morning Money. The markets, the papers and the city. Today's need to know on Share Radio.
Every morning from 6 to 9, tune in to Morning Money on Share Radio.
With Sandra Kilhoff and Mark Johnson.
An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business.
Giving you all the day's need to know.
Morning Money.
Getting you ready for the day ahead.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome to you. I'm Georgie Frost here every weekday from 9 until 1 on Digital Online and through the Share Radio mobile app. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, are in the studio with me now. So we've spoken about ISAs in great length there. Let's turn our attention to something that always seems to be rather popular with our listeners and your readers, and that is cars. Fuel efficiency has rocketed to the top of our wish lists in recent years when we're buying a car. But can you really trust the car maker's claims? Well, what car has a test that challenges what the manufacturers say? And Lee is about to reveal the 10 most true economical cars. Firstly, Lee, what was the problem with the old test?
Well, it's not an old test.
Or the official test.
It's the official test. So they're not tested in real world conditions. Now, what we mean by that is what car actually tests them on a variety of roads. So they say that they take the cars on motorways, A roads, B roads, through towns, villages. By doing all of that and other sort of intrinsic tests, they say that they come up with a more accurate figure for fuel economy. Now, the official tests are actually done by the government, and then manufacturers then can pass them off as this is our official mile per gallon and how much fuel economy it does. But
where are they done? In labs
just
or something?
In labs. And
the manufacturers obviously know exactly how those tests are going to work, so they can basically optimise their cars to pass those tests. And, you know, fuel efficiency is hugely important for manufacturers in recent years. And you can actually find them in sometimes like detuning engines. So you get less power out of your engine in order for it to like do better in those tests. But then, as Lee says, you take them out on the roads and drive them like a normal person, you don't get anywhere close.
So what did the results reveal?
Well, the top car, actually, so they test new cars every 12 months. And the one that came out on top this time around was the Seat Leon. But even so, it did 63.2 miles to the gallon. The official is 85.6.
Ooh.
So 26% difference. So that's quite a chunky amount. And if you drive that over a year, and depending on how many miles you do, that can be quite a bigger petrol bill than what you expect. Also, what I think is really interesting on this is that they've got a list of cars that have MPG, a true MPG that's so far away from official MPG. So the top one was actually the Ford Fiesta Z-Tech, which on official test, they say does 62.8 miles to the gallon. But in the what car test, 39.7.
Ooh.
So that's a 37% difference.
You know, some of these cars right at the top of that are really marketed as being economical cars as well. It's not just a sort of random thing. Those are cars that are pushing that eco button for people.
Exactly. And it is a massive deal. I know we were...
Well, it can change how you buy a car.
Exactly, yeah. If you're doing a long amount of miles, and we were saying there about in February, fuel prices coming down substantially, but now they're back on the way up, and it can add, you know, a substantial amount to your monthly outgoings if you get a car that ends up not doing anywhere near the fuel efficiency that you were expecting.
But you could do better. So, with my Top Gear hat on, you want your car to actually be more efficient than the manufacturer says. You need to buy a fast one. So you could get a Vauxhall VXR8, and that actually does 5.4% better true MPG than the official combined one. The Aston Martin V8 Vantage S, that'll do 5.9% better
true MPG. These manufacturers have undersold how fuel efficient their cars are.
And you could get, my favourite would be a Jaguar F-Type R, which is the one I'd take. That's only 0.8% better, but it is still slightly better. And it's the nicest car out of all those three.
Oh, in that case, I'm going for the Aston Martin. Lee, you, what are you taking?
I think I'd definitely take the Aston Martin. Yeah.
Ooh,
sorry. To
Skoda's on here as well.
No Lada, though, which is disappointing.
No Lada. Error.
One thing people might want to watch out for here, and something that we talked about a few weeks back, is that most of these, I think this entire top 10 of the most fuel-efficient cars are diesels. And people might be aware that there's a bit of a backlash going on about diesel at the moment. Basically, there's a suggestion that whilst it might be more economical and produce lower CO2 emissions, they produce more of other harmful particles into the air. And there is a push for a diesel scrappage scheme where people would basically be essentially paid to take their diesels off the road. There is a push to exclude them from certain town centres, city centres. And there's also a council that is charging people extra money on their residence parking permits if they own any form of diesel car. And that council had actually previously, in the past, pushed people to buy diesels by rating its own parking charges based on CO2 emissions, and has then turned around and whacked, I think it's 80 or 100 quid extra on diesels. And that is my council, Islington Council, which I'm delighted about because I've got a diesel car.
I think if you're going to buy a diesel, I think you need to be doing a certain mileage a year. I think they're not really ideal for sort of city runabout type vehicles. I think if you're a sort of businessman that goes up and down the country, does a certain amount of miles a year, let's say 10,000 miles a year, diesel is definitely the way to go because it's going to be more economical for you. But I think if you do shorter journeys, I think you'd better off sticking with a petrol.
Which is because basically they cost more to buy in the first place. So a lot of the manufacturers, you know, the premium on buying the new diesel car is a couple of grand extra on the petrol version. And there's a certain amount of mileage that you've got to do to make that up. And also diesel is about 10p more expensive for the fuel. But a lot of the new petrol cars are very, very efficient. But what's really interesting is how far car makers have actually pushed efficiency in recent years. If you look at some of these cars on here, take a look at this, the Jaguar F-Type R, right? The true MPG on that is 25 miles to the gallon. Now, if you went back 10, 15 years ago, you'd be getting 25 miles to the gallon on your family saloon, if you were lucky. And this is a very, very fast, high-performance sports car. In fact, the fastest version and most high-performance of that type of car. Same with a Porsche Cayenne V8 Turbo, which is basically a 4x4 car that goes stupidly fast. That does 20 miles to the gallon. And it's actually astonishing the extra amount of efficiency that car makers have managed to squeeze out of these engines. And that's all down a lot of pressure on them to do so. So it's interesting. Think of all those years when they were just making very inefficient cars and they could have been making much more efficient ones but just couldn't be bothered.
All I was thinking there is, if you put your CV into Top Gear, I hear there's a space going.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
I wonder where Lamborghini came in this list. Why do I say that? Well, of course, it means only one thing, and that's pensions. After a year of hype, pension freedom reforms arrive on Monday the 6th to allow retirees much greater access to their money. But with that opportunity comes, of course, a golden opportunity for fraudsters. So how can you avoid being caught out? Simon, before we talk about this, what are the new pension freedoms? You're like, you're going to pray there, Simon.
Taking a deep breath to talk about pensions freedom.
You said this once before, twice before, maybe?
People might have heard about this thing. It's been dominating the news for some time, if you read the financial pages. Basically, from Monday, people are going to get much more flexible access to their pension pots. Whereas in the past, most people who had a defined contribution pension, which is one where they've invested the money themselves rather than their employer promising to pay them a certain amount in retirement, those people with those pension pots previously would have probably had to buy an annuity with them. The vast majority would have done. Now they can leave that pension invested and draw money from it as they choose. It's totally changed the pensions game, and it's going to give a lot of people who are coming up to retirement a whole world of different options. People are going to be able to get this money from the age of 55, so you could theoretically do it whilst you were still working. There's probably going to be quite a few people who probably do try and tap into some of that cash while they are still working. But with a golden opportunity for savers also comes a golden opportunity for fraudsters to try and take their savings off them. So be very careful.
Indeed. Well, personal finance expert Sarah Pennells, founder of the savvywoman.co.uk website, has had quite a few people contact her about just this thing.
I get emails from a number of people who say to me, I've been contacted by this company and they're promising me a review of my pension. It sounds like a really good idea. Is it? The trouble is that, I mean, fraudsters are getting much more sophisticated, you know, fraudsters and rogues. And what they will do typically is capitalise on something that's genuine. So people have, you know, it rings a bell in their mind because they think, yes, I've heard about this. I've heard there's some sort of government review or government advice. And it sounds very plausible. But often what they want to do is to get you to transfer your pension. Now, at best, you'll probably end up paying a lot more in fees and charges than you need to. At worst, you could have your money in some very dodgy investments. And we've already seen some people who've lost 20, 30, even £40,000 in their pension rates. So I think it's a very genuine fear from some people, and they are getting targeted. The advice is very simple. You can get free guidance through this government initiative called PensionWise. And if you qualify for the pension freedom, so basically if you have a pension pot and you're age 55 or over, then you can get this free guidance. But you have to contact PensionWise. So if you get information from your pension company, by law, they have to tell you how you can contact PensionWise. And you can also go on to the website, which is pensionwise.gov.uk. So you always know that if somebody rings you out of the blue and says, I'm from a government organisation, I can give you some free advice, they're not from PensionWise, because you have to call them first. And I would be very suspicious and just assume that they're fraudsters or rogues.
And hang up.
And absolutely hang up, yes.
And hang up, lads.
Yes, or make pig noises down the phone, as some of our readers suggested last week in our What to Do with Cold Callers. You could blow a whistle at them as well, someone suggested, but I think that's a bit mean. But it's highly unlikely that any form of reputable financial firm will be cold calling you to try and get your pension money off you, especially if they're offering any form of guaranteed return, return above what you could get on the stock market, things like, oh, 10% a year, guaranteed, 5 years, that kind of thing. Be really wary about this. Also, your bank will not phone you up and tell you that your account has been compromised and you need to move your money to a safe account. And just watch out as well for people coming around door to door trying to sell you all kinds of bonkers schemes. Like, someone mentioned this the other day of a sort of like, you should invest your £30,000 pension pot in a ground source heat pump and then you'll never have to pay for your heating again. And actually, if you consider the return on that, you'll be getting 7% a year or something like that. Just be really careful about anybody who tries to part you and your money or tries to get you to buy something.
I think what's really worrying as well is the amount of information that some of these fraudsters could have on you. So if they called up, they will have quite a bit of data on you, and there's been a great
it's a fantastic expose by the
Daily Mail of this week. So it's not just been about pensions, but it's been about, you know, some pharmacy websites that have been selling on details of what prescriptions you've got and what, you know, problems you have.
But the ball started rolling with the pension secrets being sold to con men, they say, for 5 pence.
Indeed. And it just makes you wonder, when you're online and the sort of information that you're sharing, and you have these boxes when you go on certain websites that say, you know, you don't want your information to be shared with third parties and all that sort of stuff. Now, I wonder just how stringent this has been, and if they're still just getting passed on anyway. And I think it's a bit of it's shameful, really. And especially older people that are going to be affected by this, you know, are more likely to not know about these scams and not have read about them online and all of that, those sort of things. So if someone's got a lot of information on you, you naturally become a little bit more trusting because you think that they've got access to something that, you know, you're a genuine customer of.
Well, you do say, yes, I mean, it's possible a clever fraudster could use such personal information you were talking about there to get their hands on your pension savings without you ever actually agreeing to or signing to something. And a legitimate financial advisor will ask you the same kind of thing. So you just have to be very, very careful. Now, we've been hearing about warnings about this for months. Regulators in the industry, too, are obviously concerned and taking it seriously. So in sort of a three-pronged attack, the Financial Conduct Authority stepping up its Scam Smart campaign, telling people to reject cold calls, consult its warning list of dodgy firms and get impartial advice. The pensions regulator as well relaunched its own Scorpion campaign against fraud, calling on people to scam-proof their savings. And the government has launched a guidance service under the banner PensionWise. Can you ever scam-proof yourself?
I'll tell you what's a good idea is to go to a website called thisismoney.co.uk. Go and read about some of the scams and some of the fraud that's been going on. And actually go to thisismoney.co.uk/Hetherington, where you can read one of our investigators, the Mail on Sunday Ace investigator, Tony Hetherington's columns. Tony, every week, basically exposes these kind of fraudsters. Just read about some of the things that they're doing, because that's a really good education in how you can watch out for these scams, is to know what these scams are. And one of the things we've done a lot of investigations into recently is this thing called phishing, where basically someone will phone up pretending to be your bank or something, and they'll say your account's been compromised, you've got to move it to a safe one. You move all your money to a safe account, and then it bounces there and goes off into lots of different accounts. Fraudster runs off with it. And people have lost tens of thousands of pounds, their life savings. What's really disturbing about this, and Lee's done a lot of these investigations, is that on quite a few occasions, the fraudsters have seemed to know some quite crucial details, like the fact that that person, even for that very short period of time, had tens of thousands of pounds in their account.
The one that happened a few months ago was that scammers used a list of farmers that had received EU grants. So they knew that they'd had a fresh batch of EU grants, they knew the amount, they knew where the farm was located, they knew that who was in charge of the farm. Armed with that knowledge, lots of people fell foul of it, and it was, I don't know how far the investigation had gone on, but I know the police were looking into it and various other action fraud MPs even were getting involved, because there were some real pockets of the country that were affected by it, where fraudsters simply managed to get that information and used it to scam dozens of people.
It shows how savvy and switched on they are.
It does, yeah. So, I mean, you know, the best thing you can do as a consumer is to be savvy and switched on as well. But the chances are that maybe if you're listening to this show, you're listening to Share Radio, you're reading This Is Money, then you probably know about these kind of things. But you might know some people who don't know about these kind of things. So do warn them. You know, if you've got elderly relatives, if you know a farmer, go warn them about what Lee just said. You know, if you know people who you think, yeah, God, that could happen to them, that would be absolutely terrible, warn those people, tell them about it, spread the word, because that's the best possible way in fighting back against these fraudsters, is basically educating people to the fact that they're out there, they know a lot of stuff, and you just need to be really careful.
So is that it? Just be on your guard? It all sounds very sensible. Just hang up. Surely there would be no problem, right?
Yeah, but it's, you know, con men are convincing, aren't they? This is the problem. And a lot of these things, they use technology, but they are just very old-fashioned con tricks. I don't know, what's the common thread in a con trick? Maybe people acting too hastily or something like that. I mean, they're very good at, you know, grooming people over time, aren't they? Take a deep breath, tell someone you trust about it. I don't know. There's no magic bullet, is there? Because people have been conning each other for the length of time. But, you know, there's stuff you can do to try and be aware and fight back.
Another common one I was going to say with con men as well is it was, again, in the last 12 months that we've seen a big rise in, is that Common will say, look, if you don't believe who I am over the phone, hang up the phone, pick it up and dial, you know, the genuine number of your bank, or it might be pension wise, it might be another pensions provider. They'll hang the phone up, dial the number, but the common hasn't hung up. They're still on the other end of the line. So they pick up and they think they're speaking to someone else within the company, or they've dialed back this genuine number and believe it's someone, oh, they must work there if they're picking up after this number. Some of it's quite sophisticated.
Lee, as I've got you here, I will stick with the pension theme. What's the latest on pensioner bonds?
Oh, do you know, while I was away on holiday, all I kept thinking about was pensioner bonds and how much had been poured in. Actually, I'm doing another investigation you'll be happy to hear, which should
Excellent.
Be ready for next week, so I'm sure will be mentioned on next week's show. Some people who applied for pensioner bonds back in January still haven't had their forms sent back, even though the money's come out of their bank account. So I've got another batch of... It's not just an isolated person. If it was just an isolated person, I'd understand it. There's been quite a few people that have been in touch with me still without the documentation to say that they have a pensioner bond 3 months after they launched. But
I only asked you as a joke. I didn't realise it was a full-blown investigation.
It's a full-blown investigation going on. And I don't know how much it's gone in since, but obviously, you know, the deadline is, I think, 15th of May. So people still got plenty of time to open one up.
Thank you very much. I've missed you talking about pensioner bonds. Not as, I'm sure as much as you've missed talking about them.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Welcome back. I'm Georgie Frost here every weekday from 9 until 1. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money in the studio with me now. We've been speaking about pension fraudsters, pensioner bonds. But one of the big stories this week is, of course, the heady heights of fame that Rutland in the East Midlands has now been reaching. Why so? Well, that's because it's come out top of an annual Halifax Rural Areas Quality of Life Survey. It trips off the tongue so naturally, that, which tried to work out a place with the highest standard of living in the UK. So, drum roll, it was Rutland that was revealed. And why so, please, was Rutland top of that list?
Well, the factors that were included are obviously swayed by the fact that Rutland is known for its on-sport villages and charming market towns.
Could you name where Rutland was on a map before you did this story?
Yeah, I could. I could name
All
where
right,
Rutland.
Show
I
off.
Could name roughly. I'm going there in September. That's why I'm going on a weekend away in Rutland. And I also know someone who has moved to Rutland recently.
It's not Jonathan Agnew. He's from near there.
No,
oh, okay.
It's not him. No,
right,
it's the parent of a
okay,
friend
so
of mine.
I'm just exposing my poor knowledge of geography. So do continue. Why was Rutland picked?
Rutland was picked because nobody knows where it is. So Rutland was picked because the factors that in this survey are residents' health, life expectancy, crime rate, presumably a low one, not a high one, weather, employment, school results, broadband and personal well-being. And as many as 96% of Rutland's residents report that they are in good or fairly good health. The employment rate is high and the average weekly income is also on the high side at £623. The crime rate is one of the lowest in the country. The rainfall is below the national average and the number of hours of sunshine per week is higher. And if it sounds like I'm reading it, that's because I don't memorise things about Rutland in my spare time.
It sounds like paradise.
It does, doesn't it?
I think I might just up sticks and go move there.
It sounds a bit like the Caribbean, doesn't it? It's not. I think it's nice, but, you know, it doesn't quite look like that.
Hasn't it got, though? This is what I thought of it. Well, I sort of know-ish where it was. Well, we probably couldn't point it out on a map. But it's got one of the smallest number of people living there. There's something very small about it.
Well, no wonder that it's so nice to live then. When you live somewhere in London.
You antisocial.
It's like Australia. It's like the outback. There's hardly anybody there. You could drive for 2 hours in Rutland before you see another car.
One thing I would say about this report is that the people that live in these places actually tend to not particularly like these reports. As in, I know someone that lives in number three in the list, which is Uttlesford in Essex, which is sort of Saffron Warden, Stansted way. Now, I went there probably for the first time 4 or 5 years ago. This mm-hmm. report has come out every year since, and it's always in the top five. I think it was even number one year. Now, when I went through it a couple of months ago, the amount of building work that's going on there. So it's really picturesque, Essex rural village, lovely. It's only 45 minutes out of London, so quite a popular spot. But then the amount of houses that are going up, real sort of those like chocolate box type.
Well, I'm not sure we can blame places. The Halifax Rural Areas Quality of Life Survey but on the building of homes.
Because it's got a high quality of living, I think, you know, developers might be jumping on the back of that a little bit. I'm not saying
because there's space as well.
Completely to blame. And of course there is space, but it's green belt land, and you know people that have moved there, that could soon be going down the list because
it's
too built up.
Indeed, it's the same where I'm from and one of my family's from, which has also made the list, by the way.
What's interesting about this list is probably if you take some of the places like perhaps Rutland, which is a bit of a distance from London, and probably not the easiest commute out of it. There's a lot of places here where people are doing a commute probably into London, or maybe there's also South Cambridgeshire, where Cambridge is obviously a real hot spot of employment and sort of, you know, the tech industry at the moment. But, the Chilterns, South Northamptonshire, South Cambridge, Mid Sussex, Huntingdonshire, South Oxfordshire, East Hertfordshire, East Cambridgeshire, Tonbridge. You know, these are all places where a lot of people are going to be commuting into London, or at least one member of a family is going to be commuting into London for work. The other thing that's interesting about it is, yeah, everybody wants to live that sort of country rural dream, don't they? But then you've got this scenario, like you say, where there's a lot of pressure to build houses in these kind of places. And, you know, underlying all of this stuff is this real tussle going on out there with people who just simply do not trust house builders and local authorities not to build a load of not very good houses and not enough infrastructure.
Isn't that just NIMBYism, though, a little bit?
It's not NIMBYism, because
it is
NIMBYism, but the thing I would argue is that basically, if you're not willing to look after your backyard, who on earth do you think is going to? I mean, some of it is actually looking after your local area, because the problem with convincing people that we need more houses, and we do need to build more houses, is that they've seen decades of houses being built badly, planned badly, and not enough investment in infrastructure like schools and roads and railways and hospitals. And actually, if you go out of London, most of the hospitals are being shut and people have got to go 40 minutes to get to a hospital. So how do you convince someone who's had all the hospitals shut around them and has to go 40 minutes to get to a hospital that they should have another 5,000 homes on their doorstep?
Plenty of brownfield sites as well going, I'm sure, that can be developed instead of spoiling our beautiful countryside.
Look at you two, rural men. What I thought was interesting this survey, to take it back to the geek in me, was broadband came high up on this list.
It's considered a real essential nowadays, though. I mean, there's some places where broadband is really lousy.
We take it for granted because we're in London. We, you know, mainly have good broadband, except when Virgin decide not to make it work. But, you know, in these rural places, broadband, I would presume, the costs to get broadband into a village is expensive.
Yeah, there are still some sort of genuine black spots. And you hear people talking about things like getting satellite broadband and stuff like that. But you know, it's considered an essential. Actually, one of the funny things about these surveys, just before we finish on it, that Lee briefly mentioned, is people commenting on these, is we actually had another survey last week that we published, which named the best place, the most highest quality of living or something in the UK. And it basically said a place called Bebbington had the highest quality of living, which is up somewhere, I think, on the Wirral. Basically.
Don't ask me, I don't know.
someone told me, I'd never heard of Bebbington. We had a picture of Bebbington, which we basically was just a bridge with a river running underneath it. It looked very nice. And we had a load of readers leave comments on the bottom saying, that's not Bebbington, that's Port Sunlight, which is next door. Port Sunlight's nice, but Bebbington's not, it's horrible. It was amazing that these people could spot it, you know, just from one little picture kind of thing. Fantastic. Which I suppose you would do if it was your hometown and someone clearly put a picture of the neighbouring town on the internet, you know, then you'd go, no, that's not there, that's somewhere else. But people really feel some passion about these things.
I'll tell you one thing in radio broadcasting, if you get the place name wrong, oof. You can say loads else, but you cannot do that wrong.
You could take these things too far. I mean, you'd sound very silly if you said, I'm going to Paris.
That would be nice. Is there anything they missed out on here, do you think, lads, that you'd like to put in?
Mobile signal. I live in London and mobile signal in a flat is absolutely terrible. I live in zone two. I can't make a phone call from my flat. I think that should be in there.
I think that what it shows is basically, you know, how important in some of these places it is to be, you know, people want to live in the countryside, they want to live the rural life, but they also want to be close to a centre for employment. And I think it would be interesting actually to see one of these surveys come out that was sort of mapping the importance of those centres of employment. So like how important, for example, is Manchester to the area around it? How important is Newcastle, you know, Birmingham, things like that? But also looking at it the other way is like how many people is that getting less important? Are more businesses starting up in these rural places? Because we keep hearing all this talk of small businesses starting up in out the way places and, you know, people starting up, you know, small endeavours, or a village that once just had a dowdy old shop suddenly being turned into something that's like got a real sort of community feeling and then is expanding and stuff. But it'd be interesting to turn some of this on its head and just not to just see a list of places where you think, oh, people are probably commuting from there, to see what's actually going on underneath all of that.
But Georgie, I'll drive a Lada up to Rutland. Yeah, I'll give you a report next week. I'll let you know what it's like
road
up there.
Road trip
up there, yeah.
Road trip to Rutland.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.